Good morning. Bruce Rawls here with me for the House of the Rising Sun. And
good morning, Lynn and all.
So Bruce, how's your week? What's going on? You got this big holiday weekend going on here. Anything happening in your
end of- just more of the same. I've been working with a friend in Germany on a new website, which people will be familiar with when it's unveiled, and making great progress. So having a lot of fun with that. Yeah, and other things. So too numerous to mention. But anyway, I thought it'd be fun to talk about another FAQ. I've just, as you know, reading through those sequentially, and I came upon this one the other day. I thought, boy, what a loaded one. And I actually do have another appointment at 7, believe it or not, in Pacific time. So if we could wrap it up close to that, that would be good.
That'd be fine too. Yeah.
And there's a lot of material in this one. So maybe the thing to do would be to do more reading and less commentary on this one, just because I think there's a lot of good stuff in there. What do you think?
Let's do it.
Does that sound good?
That sounds good.
This is 1143, FAQ 1143 from facimoutreach.org, and you can find those by going to the sequential list of frequently asked questions on that website. So how about if I just dive in and read the question, and then you can start in with the answer. How's that sound?
Let's see how you dive in.
Okay, so this is question number 1143, and it goes, I have a question about emotionality and special relationships. I seem to have had one which resulted in both extreme love and feeling nothing at all simultaneously. Could you recommend anything on how to deal with extreme emotional ties, where you know that it does not help you any further, but you are still unable to let go? I am somewhat confused by the fact that one person can rouse both extreme love / hate and remind me at the same time of a more universal love. I suppose both are, but in me, but it's difficult to deal with. I have tried to work on this with a number of psychologists, but to no avail, basically. The decision to leave seems to be mine, but it appears kind of cold. I suspect my question comes down to, quote, what is love, unquote. How does A Course in Miracles define love? I feel I'm physically and emotionally in pain, almost to the point of withdrawal symptoms, special love, hate, in parentheses. I read the Course and understand it on a mental level, but emotionally feel all the hurt and pain. Healing only comes in small, in parentheses, illusionary steps. Why do we do this to ourselves? Indian yogic systems use extreme emotions as breakthroughs to the more universal love. I suppose A Course in Miracles would not approve of any such techniques. Do you want to read the answer? First paragraph? I thought this was a great setup question.
It is a really good setup question. And of course, you know, it's kind of hard to know what to do when you're in this kind of situation. Mm-hmm. But I remember being very conflicted early on, especially. And it seems like now it's this kind of a no-brainer. But there may be a lot of stuff going on that I don't even know under the surface too. So, I know this week my dog died on Monday. I'm just still in like shock.
Oh boy.
You know, so I understand. I mean, this is an animal.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Sure. And,
you know, it's been very painful. I don't even know why I'm getting teary now.
Oh, well, but, of course. That's not unexpected, right?
Yeah, early in the morning, he's always, like, right behind me, follows me everywhere, you know, sit outside the door when the door is closed waiting for me to open it up.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's kind of a weird thing.
Oh,
anyway,
sure.
Sorry.
Oh, no, that's completely understandable. I'd be doing the same thing. Yeah.
Right, the same thing.
Yeah.
And,
So
it may be helpful to remember that extreme emotional feelings are really not different from milder experiences of the same feelings. And there's a couple of references to Workbook Lessons 21 and the Manual for Teachers. And our attempts to make sense of them, regardless of their intensity, are merely clever diversions orchestrated by our egos to keep us from recognizing the real issue. all pain comes from our decision to see ourselves as separate from love. And that is a reference from text 28. The scripts of our lives with all their various relationships are ego symbols that play out in form the ultimate ego drama in the mind, one in which we believe we are pitted in a life and death struggle with God, who seeks vengeance for our attack on him. When we wrested our autonomous individual self from his oneness, and the ego tells us that struggle is one in which that struggle is one in which we, in the end, we will lose, for we shall all die. Okay. First off,
compelling, huh?
Before we go any further, I do not remember ever having attacked God, left God, have any kind of notion in my mind that I did these things. Mm-hmm. So how would I be feeling guilty about it?
This is the question. Yeah.
You know, how would I be feeling guilty about something I don't even recognize?
Right.
So, you know, before we go on, I would really like to explore just a little bit of that.
Sure.
Because unless you get it, that this is what you're doing and how you're doing it, then you're never going to get any of this stuff.
Yeah. That's a really super important, question and point to bring up. Cause I think on most everyday, experience, we're not consciously aware of that. And I think that's where the world around us brings us examples on a silver platter of what's going on in our unconscious mind. I think the challenge is that we find things that are unpleasant, such as, you know, this experience with your dog passing. And we all have those kinds of experiences from time to time. Some of them hit us harder than others. But inevitably, they're symbolic emissaries of a system that we forgot that we made so long ago that we essentially have lost all memory of it. But the idea is that somehow we messed up perfect oneness. And if we think about it logically and calmly, which usually is the last thing from our minds in those circumstances, we would realize, well, that's impossible. I mean, I think that's where the supreme logic of the Course comes in. And it's not a cold-hearted logic. It's basically a very healing logic that is really comforting. When we realize that we could not have possibly lost our innocence or the peace that passes understanding, or, you know, however you want to describe that feeling of complete comfort, that we seem to have abandoned, but we never did. And that's I think what is so challenging about our curriculum is that, you know, we get countless examples, and sometimes we go for long stretches or seemingly long stretches where things seem to be going good in our dream world. But eventually, you know, something will happen, like, you know, the situation with your dog, for example, and I've had similar situations with pets that have gone and family members and lost, you know, an aunt and an uncle that were very dear to me last year, for example. And yet, if I can remember that the spirit that I appreciated in those pets or those family members or friends, lovers, whatever, coworkers, you know, anyone that has become near and dear to us, really in our right minds becomes a symbol of the interconnectedness and the oneness that we never left. And it's only in our, shall we say, you know, misinterpreted dreams that we think that they represent something that we messed up with, you know. Does that seem to ring true, Lynn?
Oh, absolutely it does.
Yeah.
Absolutely it does. And, you know, just looking at how guilt plays into this, and that's the other thing that, you know, I think that if you don't recognize the guilt, then you'll never get why everything seems so crappy.
Right.
Understand why everything hurts so much. Yeah. If you don't understand why it is that I, you know, feel guilty. And so, you know, why is it that I feel guilty about my dog? Okay. There were like lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of stuff. I can't even begin to go through the list of every time, you know, he was annoying, he was irritating, I tripped over him all the time, I cursed him every day. Seriously, every day I said, I wish you were dead, you know, literally, because, you know, I almost fell down the stairs several times because, you know, he was just crazy.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So, you know, every bad wish I thought, every time I ever, you know, wish something or the other had, you know, was different with him, you know, I feel guilty about those things because, again, I'm, you know, seeing through the ego eyes all of the things that I could have done better, that I didn't do right, that I messed up, that I had a bad thought in my mind, that I had an angry, upset thought in my mind, that I, anything, all of those things are things that when you look at them, you can't help but notice that you feel guilty about it. And why do you feel guilty about it? Because you believe that you're really doing it. You believe that it's really real. You look around at this world that seems so wacky. And when you start beginning to realize your own responsibility for this wacky world, which it becomes really evident after a while, you know, first you feel like you're just a total victim and you have nothing to say about it. But then, you know, you begin to realize that, no, I'm the one who's making this up. You know, I'm the one who, you know, in my mind thought, you know, this, I'm being persecuted by a dog, you know, even though, you know, I always knew that it wasn't true and therefore I felt guilty because, you know, I was angry about something that wasn't true. So why, this idea that, you know, I could be living in a perfect heaven right now, except for these choices that I keep making about, you know, my opinion about the world, about, you know, the dog, about the, you know, everything. I could be living in a perfect world where everything is heaven, except I keep choosing these lousy choices. And so if only that were the reason I felt guilty, I could understand it. That, you know, I'm feeling guilty because I'm, you know, I'm the one who's doing it. But then to come down to the point where I realized that my distance from God, my loss of connection that I feel with God, all of this is because of, again, my own choice. Mm-hmm. I'm making that choice at every moment. It's not a choice I made long ago and I'm feeling bad about that. It's a choice I'm making right now. And so it's not a distant guilt. It's a current guilt.
Exactly. So we keep rehashing, regurgitating, and reenacting the tiny mad idea over and over again. As you're talking about that, I was thinking, wow, there's plenty of other examples, like, you know, kids whose parents divorce when they're young, or even in my case, in adolescence, you know, and then you think, well, gee, am I responsible? And there's sort of this archetypal thing of, oh, I'm somehow to blame for this. You know, feeling of discomfort and that sort of thing. And that's the obvious thing that we do whenever there's conflict in our lives. You know, we unconsciously, you know, assume the guilt, which in a sense is, but it's only because we're looking at a dream that it's incorrect. And we never see that it's a dream until we realize that we're, you know, we're projecting it out and then reel it back in, and then by taking responsibility for it and looking at it with our inner kindness teacher, with that inner integrity and strength and peaceful awareness that knows that we can look at that crazy thought system and see that it's unfounded. And that's where the you know, I think the cosmic logic comes in, where we realize, no, that perfection hasn't been lost. We've just been, in the immortal words of Eddie Murphy, wookin' panub, you know, looking for love in all the wrong places. If you remember that SNL skit, I love the spoof he did on that.
Yeah, buckwheat.
buckwheat. Yeah, exactly. Buckwheat. But that's what we do. I mean, isn't that the silliest thing that we keep looking over and over to find happiness in the one place that we know we're never going to find it, you know, which is basically returned to us in the form of, you know, a relationship that never changes, you know, whether it's a person or an animal that expresses mortality or our own bodies or a situation or, you know, whether it's financial or career wise or, you know, the list is endless, but
anything
that's disappointing obviously is a misinvestment of our identity, and we have to gently ease ourselves into that awareness over time, I think, because if we were to do it all at once, we'd realize, well, wait a minute, this identity I've made up, it's just totally bogus. But I think if we just kind of look at it moment to moment with each situation that comes up, each little emotional twinge, each little tug at our heartstrings that brings us out of a feeling of peace becomes a perfect opportunity to say to ourselves, gee, maybe I chose the wrong teacher here. And I don't have to beat myself up about it. I can just allow the feelings that I have. It's not about denying the feelings or the emotions. It's about looking at them with a different teacher and seeing that the one that we were looking at it with, the very self-incriminating one, it just flat is a miserable choice, and it doesn't make us happy. And why would we continue to masochistically, do that kind of thing?
Exactly. And the fact that you can actually choose again and completely shift the entire situation in your mind. That is the proof right there.
Mm-hmm.
That is because of my own choice that I'm feeling this way.
Yeah.
And so what I've been really, this whole thing has been bringing up in me, and I've been crying like buckets. Every day I'm crying. I cry over everything. And, you think, well, that's kind of like, feeling guilty or grief or whatever. Actually, what it is actually seeing my part in everything that has ever hurt me. It's like, something comes up and, I see a thing about, some dog that, was in the middle of the road and somebody bravely went out and saved them. And, I look at that and I think, my God, I could be saving all the dogs. the guilt, the joy in seeing that someone has stepped out of their comfort zone to do something wonderful. And every time you see something like that, you admire it, you love it, you think it's wonderful, and you feel guilty because you're not doing it yourself. It's the ego has just got this perfect trap set up.
Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna mix metaphors here.
Okay.
In response to what you said, I'm gonna not one dog in heaven's song was missed.
I love it. Oh,
kind of reminds me of one of my favorite jokes about the dyslexic agnostic insomniac who stayed up all night wondering if there really was a dog. But it's interesting because dog and God are, make a palindrome, and not that that's, any profound thing or anything, but everything really can be a symbol of a gentle reminder that to look at the form and not condemn ourselves to the form, because I've certainly had periods where I've, shed my share of tears and but it's all the purpose, isn't it? Because when you let go and allow yourself to just experience and let the expression that seems appropriate come through, whether it's grieving or whatever, but don't condemn yourself for it. If I remember to not condemn myself for when I see something that is my projection and say, oh, This is an opportunity to look at the contents of my unconscious mind and not condemn myself and just allow the external circumstances, whether it seems to be happy or joyous or not, to flow through me. And, then that can be very cathartic and healing when we, again, take the hand of, the the Jesus of the Course, the Holy Spirit, a.k.a. Inner Kindness Teacher, and just say, wow, this really looks different, seen from that perspective, seen from above the battleground of our projections, where we can stop condemning ourselves for what seems to be happening and see it all in perspective.
And start accepting our own innocence in the whole situation,
yes.
Which is the next part of this, yep. is once I begin to see that, you know, the only thing I'm really responsible in the scenario, in the script, because this was all happening, because it happened long ago. My dog, you know, if my imaginary dog in my imaginary life, in my imaginary world, in planet Earth, it happened long ago. So this is just a time for me to look at it and to recognize my own innocence in the whole situation. That I'm not, that nothing really happened. Mm-hmm. And it's not because I'm trying to brush away what happened. It's because when you see it from the perspective of the Course, you actually see that you had nothing to do with any of the circumstances. You know, my behavior last week didn't change the way the dog was on Monday. It didn't do anything because it was all a part of, not that I did anything last week, but I'm just saying anything that happened previous to that particular happening is not something I could go back and change. Mm-hmm. You can't change the past.
Right.
And you've got to understand, even right now, what we're doing is the distant past.
Yes.
Like a mind blowing.
What a bunch of nostalgia freaks we are, huh?
We are. And yeah, nostalgia is really a good word. My friend Bob Ferguson uses that word, and I think it was something Richard Rose uses a lot. You know, it's that remembering of the feeling, and so this is all we're doing is remember, bringing the members back together,
exactly.
And. So it's a beautiful situation, and you know, I don't want to belabor this any much longer. Just to know.
I'm glad you brought it up, Lynn, because I think it's such a perfect example of the kind of stuff that we all go through. And again, you know, sometimes the circumstances seem more, you know, significant than others, but it's all the same thing, isn't it?
It is. It's all the same thing. And you know, and also, you know, you think about I'm not trying to justify anything or anything, but you know, that was a dog that we picked up from the pound, and uh-huh. he would have been, you know, terminated years ago. I don't, you
uh-huh.
know.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the time that, you know, the life that we had together, you know, it was for a purpose. And, you know, the purpose was to bring me to this realization where I'm at right now. So, you know, nothing is ever wasted. Nothing is ever lost. You haven't done anything wrong.
Yeah.
All it's doing is just these little reminders that the Holy Spirit just threw in behind all of these happenings, all of these situations, because the script was written. What could he do? What could the Holy Spirit do? Once we made that choice to come here and to live in this world, we wrote everything that was ever going to happen. The only thing the Holy Spirit could do was to go in behind every single one of those things and put the miracle there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this is. Every time something like this happens, you know there's a miracle behind it. And so just to ask for the miracle. Have you ever just done that? Just said, I don't know what to do right now. I need please.
Yeah. I've been doing that frequently in a technical way. It's like, you know, I'm delving into some stuff that's like, I'm not sure what the heck I'm doing here. I need to ask for help. And I have been, and I've been getting tremendous help. But sometimes it's on a more, you know, a less technical level too. But the principle holds in anything. You know, if we can remember to just ask for help. And as you were speaking a moment ago, I couldn't help remembering one of my favorite places in the Course, and I always paraphrase it. One of these days I'll actually maybe memorize it. But, you know, that it says, you know, I've saved all of your love and kindness, you know, and and kept them for you, safe from what, you know, I'm totally paraphrased there, but it's, you know, essentially saying that, that none of that is lost. And none of the kindnesses that we've expressed, whether it's rescuing a dog from the pound or just opening the door for someone with a smile or, you know, just, you know, going out of our way a little bit to, you know, see something from another person's perspective and just maybe catching ourselves on the threshold of condemning something and saying, nah, I'm not going to go there. You know, it doesn't matter. Any gesture of kindness is not wasted. It changes the entire cosmos. And, you know, even in the level of the dream that we call space time, it really does. I mean, it shifts the whole paradigm. And on the level where really, like you say, already happened. we're remembering to not take that dream so seriously, and that is the shared interest that we all have, is in going home together. So every little kind gesture or thought contributes toward our increased comfort with that thought system, to where we eventually accept that completely and allow the resistance to just drop away altogether. Should I read the next paragraph?
Exactly. And I just was going to tell you, that is from Chapter 5, Section 4, Teaching and Healing. This is one of my favorite sections of the entire Course in Miracles. Mm-hmm. And this is where he says this very, very famous line that so many of us forget. How can you who are so holy suffer?
Suffer. That's it. That's it.
All your past except its beauty is gone, and nothing is left but a blessing. I have saved all of your kindnesses and every loving thought that you ever had. I have purified them of the errors that hid their light and kept them for you in their own perfect radiance. So everything that happened long ago, every good thought that we've ever had, it's all here. It's all here. So.
Thank you, Lynn. Yeah, that's on page 83 in the more recent editions, and it's paragraph 8 of section 4, Teaching and Healing in chapter 5. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, that is such a favorite, but it's so true, and we forget that. I think we forget it because we're, you know, we're such incredibly talented actors and role players that we've, you know,
we have to forget it. If we don't forget it, then this doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
None of this illusion is going to make sense if you start remembering.
Mm-hmm. And none of us are ready for the big game over flashing across our minds. You know, so we have to kind of give ourselves, you know, permission to have a little dose at a time. So.
Exactly. Okay. So go on to the next paragraph.
Okay. Maybe we'll get through at least some of it. It would probably be ambitious, but because it's a fairly long one, but it's good. Okay. And it continues. Why do the feelings, both positive and negative, seem more intense? I always love the word seem. Seem more intense within some relationships than others. There is really no answer to that question except to say that when the ego scripts were written long ago, some of the script symbols, that is, the figures within the dream, seem to be invested with more projected guilt than others. And so those symbols, which seem to be external to us, are mirroring the hidden contents of our minds, which we do not want to accept within ourselves. More intense relationships provide us an opportunity to look deeper within ourselves. And that's where some of those situations, when they come up, that seem to trigger more emotion than others or more intense feelings or whatever we want to call it, can be wonderful gifts from what we think is some, you know, separate part of ourselves. It's really an aspect of ourselves reaching out back through our mind to show us that nothing was lost. And I think I've found a real tremendous solace in years when friends have passed on or family members. A lot of times what I'm now almost in the, you know, knee-jerk habit of doing, in addition to noticing, you know, my feelings and not squashing or suppressing or, you know, denying that, but also bringing those same feelings on this altar of the mind right next to each other with the awareness that what those persons or animals or whatever have been to me is a representation of all of spirit. And I remember the kindnesses and the love and the fun and the humor that was shared in that individual's lifetime. And the metaphor that I that comes to mind for me in so many cases is the smile and the, just the gentle radiance of what that, that person's real essential spirit is all about and has been, despite the you know conflicts and through the conflicts. I mean, you know, because none of the things that seem you know euphorically positive or or negative could possibly be true. Anything that changes is not true. But I think that quality of the eternal smile or the infinite embrace, the awareness of the kindness and it really transcends affection. But it's that quality that of shared interest and camaraderie and companionship that is unchangeable, that stays with us. And I think if we bring that to mind along with our grieving, not to deny the grieving, but to bring it right alongside next to those same thoughts and feelings on the altar, then there can be tremendous healing that takes place.
Absolutely. And that's the purpose of all of it because it's so drastic. If we could be healed through just the gentle lessons of the Holy Spirit and just, you know, every time something happened, we just turned to Him and we got it. If we could be healed like that, then, you know, we'd have all been healed a long time ago. But the fact is that, you know, we're very, very stubborn in trying to maintain our sense of righteousness and our belief that we haven't done anything wrong. At the same time, we know that we shouldn't have done this, and we're accusing ourselves of, being this hideous character. The Holy Spirit just laughs. You know, Jesus laughs when he sees us going through this little quandary, because he knows that it's really, honestly, we're fooling ourselves. We're doing it to ourselves. He says that to us over and over. We're doing it to ourselves, and we can stop doing it at any moment. It's just like, I have my little grandson, he'll be 3 in August. He wanted something or something didn't happen the way he wanted, and he's crying like crazy. I go in there, the kitchen, and I get a Twizzler, Twizzler, the red licorice,
uh-huh.
A Twizzler. I bring it into him. I don't even say anything. I just stand there. I have this Twizzler. He's crying like a maniac. He looks up and he says, "Oh," he takes it. He smiles. Thank you. And he's a happy boy. He's a happy boy. Why? Because he chose again. He's learning at an early age that, you know, that you can choose to be miserable and kick and scream and cry, or you can choose to smile and get a Twizzler. You know, that
and glucose is the answer to everything. No, just kidding. But yeah, but it's the kindness that's behind the gesture, obviously, that what he's responding to, right? That's always such an important thing, is to remember that we can learn to generalize and realize that it's not the specific, it's not the Twizzler, but it's the kindness that motivated you to get that and bring it to him that is really the response to what's in himself that is the answer to all to all seeming problems that only seem different, which I think
exactly.
This FAQ addresses so nicely.
Exactly. So let me go on to the next paragraph.
Okay.
Should we ever allow ourselves to look calmly beyond the external relationship to the underlying conflict within, Jesus assures us we would see the inner battle with God as merely silly and not at all serious. You know, he's going to give us a Twizzler. And we're going to say, oh, what was I mad about?
Jesus and the Twizzler syndicate, right?
Twix or Twizzler. The Twixes are even better.
Oh, okay.
But they're messy. So the Twizzlers were. Okay. But the world of relationships keeps our focus outside the mind so that we attribute all of the intensity and emotionality to the interactions we seem to be having with other individuals separate from ourselves. So we're blaming it all on it's what you did. It's not how I feel about what you did. It's what you did.
Right.
That's upsetting me. It's, you are the one who's caught the responsible for my inner feeling rather than my own decision to be unhappy. Mm-hmm. So,
boy, that nails it.
This is how we are experiencing the conflict, and we are not expected to deny our feelings. But we are being invited to consider a different interpretation of our experiences, one in which we learn to recognize that we are solely responsible for our feelings. And, of course, that comes from the very famous responsibility for sight section there. Solely responsible for our feelings, and others are simply the excuses we have made up to assign the responsibility elsewhere. And so long as we project responsibility for our feelings outside ourselves, no genuine healing is possible. Okay, that is the bottom line of A Course in Miracles. As long as we project responsibility for our feelings outside ourselves, no genuine healing is possible. Only a pseudo-healing that involves special love bargains, or compromises in which we always feel we must give up something in order to get what we think we want. So it's that sacrifice, that's that give to get. All of those things come into play here. Mm-hmm. And, we're trying to make some kind of compromise with this ego self who is a ranting child. And
as you're saying that, I was thinking, boy, you know, usually we look at the media that we consume, and we can spot, you know, really shoddy marketing, and then sometimes there's really, you know, clever and sophisticated marketing. But the most sophisticated marketing and the most amazingly pervasive and highly consumed and, you know, hook, line, and sinker propaganda is the thought system of the ego. We bought into that so thoroughly, but forgetting that we made it up. But because we made it up, and because we're invested in a seemingly separate self, it's like, well, you know, it's kind of like climbing up Everest the hard way. You know, it's like, well, I got all the Sherpas and spent tens of thousands of dollars on this mountaineering equipment and the oxygen tanks and the freeze dried food and the extra, sub-zero clothing and sleeping bags. And you're telling me there's an enclosed escalator up to the top of Everest? How dare you? You know? How dare you give me that option? You know? But that's because we bought the marketing for all the gear and all the paraphernalia that the ego says is required. And that's why the thought system that we're talking about is incredibly simple. It's unimaginably simple because we don't want to imagine it because we made up an identity that's thoroughly invested in doing it my way.
Right. And it's the investment that we're trying to protect.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did all this work. I better be getting something out of it, and it better be worth all the work that I did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, you know, Jesus tells us that enlightenment is just a recognition. It's just a shift in perception. It's just a change of your mind. And that seems too simple for this elaborate system that I've made up, that I could just get a Twizzler and stop it. It doesn't even make sense to me. Why would that be? But it is. All it takes is bringing back that responsibility for sight to our own awareness.
Mm-hmm. It does. Just that one little willingness to say, "Oh yeah, I'm responsible for what I see," and not on the level of form. It doesn't mean that the individual that we think we are, the Bruce or the Lynn or the whoever, is the one that did it. It's really deeper than that. It's really the decision-making faculty of the mind that, you know, on a level we can't even imagine, decided that somehow it's possible for us to make up a whole world in which to hide out in from a crime we never committed. But again, the marketing and the propaganda was so effective, and we bought and we played it up and made it so bulletproof and so foolproof that, you know, within the dream, we're not going to see the door at the end of the Truman Show, you know, at the far end of the lake with a staircase, you know, that's carefully hidden by clouds painted over it, you know, until we choose to see that maybe it's our decision-making faculty and start identifying with, you know, an awareness that can
extend
the individual persona and see that it's not working for us and be willing to be shown a different way, a better way.
Yeah. A better way, exactly. You want to read the next paragraph?
Sure. Let's see. Okay. Whenever we find ourselves wanting anything from someone else, we have already made a decision to identify with the ego thought system of separation, differences, limitation, and loss. And this decision, by its very nature, must be experienced as painful, since the choice for the ego is the choice against love. How could the decision to see ourselves as bereft of love, lost in all our own, be experienced as anything but extremely painful? Yeah. But again, there's that propaganda, and we think that there's going to be some kind of payoff, but every time we get to the finish line of each episode, it's like, yeah, and so what? And why did I choose this again? You know, what was I thinking? If we're honest with ourselves, right?
Yes. Yeah. And if we're honest with ourselves, we also know what the payoff that we're expecting, and we also know that we're the one who's made up the expectation. It's yes. Just crazy, because, you know, once I started recognizing that I was doing this, I could just go look through my life and see how I've done this over and over and over and over and over, and it's such a distinct pattern, and yet at the time it just seemed mysterious to me. Why do these things keep happening to me?
You know, I, as you're saying that, I almost was thinking, sometimes when you go online and you fill out forms, usually they have this long thing of boilerplate, right? If you're using a website, for example, and it's, you know, terms and conditions, and it comes to mind because I'm working on several websites that have those kind of forms, and usually people just, you know, skim through it, yeah, yada, 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 and then there's a checkbox at the end, say, I agree to these terms and conditions, right? And you click the checkbox, and then the next button is activated or ungrade or whatever. But I think that's kind of like, but we, on some deeper level, we set a global setting on our mind's browser, so to speak, that says, skip all those. I agree to the assumptions, and part of that agreement is that I don't have to look at those assumptions as long as I'm invested in this world and invested in my projections and invested in the whole thought system of victimhood. And I can just skip past all those tedious boilerplate you know, paragraphs, and just go right on to the next disappointing situation without having recognized that my endorsement is on every event, on every page, and I, you know, whether I sign for it or just click the checkbox that I agree to the terms and conditions, it doesn't matter. It's the same result. You know, it's you know, we're the author, and we don't want to admit it.
Exactly.
But it's a dream drama. It's a hoax. It's a fantasy that we're agreeing to. Just as when we go online, you know, we're seeing something that's a representation of a thought system, and it's not reality. It's just a pictorial representation of our thoughts, and it doesn't really it's just an idea of what reality might be like in someone's mind. It's not reality.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's something you just brought up that just really hit me. The timing, I guess, or the just the way that I guess this whole script is going anyway, that, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, you wouldn't have had any context for what mm-hmm. you just said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
This is the time where the part of the script that we're in right now, where you know, I'm sure that everything in the script was pointing to the truth the whole time. But it's like it's just gotten more and more graphic now because we have these real life, quote unquote, real life examples for that a lot of people understand that you can explain these things and they're going, oh yeah, you know, like just like the internet, you know. I love it. It's perfect. This whole idea of wanting anything from anyone else, having been made the decision to identify with the ego thought system, right there, anytime we find ourselves wanting anything.
And that's in italics for emphasis.
Yes, it's in italics, exactly. Anything, it doesn't matter what it is I've agreed that I'm lacking something.
Mm-hmm.
I've agreed that something is missing. I've agreed that, you know, and so right then and there, you know, I might just stop and say, you know, what is it that I really want here and make a choice. And that choice could take me completely out of the whole dream. So, but it's that decision to think that, that somehow or the other I have excluded myself from God's love.
Right, right.
Somehow or the other I've excluded myself from God's love. And that's been, you know, it's real interesting, Bruce. I don't want to digress too much here, but we've been having, you know, being Awakening Together, and I know you've read a lot of this stuff as well. You know, all these teachers that say, just concentrate on the I am and just, you know, just concentrate on what you know, really are and, you know, go within and, all this kind of stuff. I think that's all real well and good. But, you know, I've talked to one of these teachers who, you know, offered to help me to, you know, become awakened and all this. Cause, you know, there's people out there that will, walk you through the steps to become awakened. You can become awakened. Apparently, you know, according to this whole system. But then when I talked to the teacher and they said, what do you want? What is it that you really want? And I said, what I really want is to feel the love of God within me now. What I really want is to feel my connection with God. This is the thing that I feel like I'm lacking, is this connection with God. And, you know, I could give a rip what this true self is. You know, I could care less about becoming this I am character. What I want is to just be melted into God, to be so aware of the love of God that it wouldn't matter what was, it wouldn't matter if the door opened and a bear jumped in here. You know, a big black bear or Kodiak bear, that I could just look at that bear and just know that I'm perfectly loved by God and have no fear, no worry, no idea that this physical world could touch me. That's what I want. This, you know, maybe that is knowing what I am. I'm sure that it is knowing what I am. But to me, I don't look at it that way. I could give a rip what I am. I want to be connected with my source. I want to feel the love of God within me now. That's it. You know, that's what I feel lost from. So I'm going to read the next paragraph.
Which I think addresses it perfectly.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So
as often is the case.
As for how the Course defines love, Jesus says in the introduction to the text, the Course does not aim at teaching the meaning of love, for that is beyond what can be taught. It does aim, however, at removing the blocks to the awareness of love's presence, which is your natural inheritance. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. What is keeping me from knowing that? What is keeping me from feeling that and being aware of that? Because, you know, if you knew who walked beside you, fear would be impossible. You know, you would not, there would be nothing to fear. You wouldn't identify yourself as a body. You wouldn't identify yourself with the world at all because you'd be completely identified with your source. So you will.
That's a little later on, though. But yeah. For most of us, I think we just kind of do what feels comfortable, you know, in the
right. Universe.
Yeah.
But ultimately, isn't that what everyone wants?
Yeah, of course.
You know, that's what everyone wants. Oh, it's just to feel safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
So you will find no definition of love in the Course, because love, which is our reality, is beyond all limits, all boundaries, all concepts. Nevertheless, the Course says enough about love and what love is not to make it clear that what passes for love in this world, what the Course calls special love, is at best a shabby substitute, and at worst a contradiction of love's reality. So what we call love here, what we call, this is a shabby substitute for reality, and it's a total contradiction of the reality of love.
Right.
So even when I say I love my dog, you know, I can feel all the contradictory crap coming up because, you know, it's all conditional.
Yeah. All the bargains. Exactly.
All the bargains, all the conditions.
Yep. Yep. But there's nothing wrong with that. It's just when we recognize that those things aren't going to make us happy in an unchangeable way, that I think is those pivotal moments when we realize that we do have the willingness, and that willingness isn't constant yet, but it can increase over time and can become something that is, you know, more and more, in the forefront of our awareness as we look at when we're investing in the bargains and realizing that as long as I make it conditional on someone else or something else behaving or not behaving in a certain way or doing or not doing certain things or, you know, fulfilling some part of a bargain, then I'm setting myself up for, you know, a miserable state of mind. And that's...
Exactly. Absolutely.
That's just silly.
I'm doing it to myself.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you know what, hon? It is 7 o'clock at your time.
Yeah. We could finish this next time or just let the listeners, you know, read the rest of the remaining four paragraphs, because I think there's a lot in there. And and I probably should wrap it up for this week. But next week it should have more time to run over if we need to. So.
Very good. All right, sweetie. Well, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls.
Thank you.
And,
and
I have enjoyed talking with you about this. And
Likewise.
Every week, you know, if we, really honestly, I get to see more and more and more of my own crap. So,
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. very much likewise. Have a great week, all.
Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. And have a good week. And
you
we
too.
Will see you next Saturday.
Looking forward to it.
Bye. Thank you.